Welcome to Life on the Land, a Grazie Her podcast telling the stories of women living across rural and remote Australia. I'm Em Herbert, your host for today, and oh my gosh, does it feel good to be back in your ears for our 15th season. I'm back from maternity leave with my daughter Saffron, now 8 months old and incredibly cute. The team and I are absolutely buzzing to help shine a light on some vibrant, compelling, incredible Australian women across the next 8 episodes. Let's dig in. Today's conversation is with Jessica Bidgood, a cattle producer from central Queensland. Jess lives 5 kilometres south of Baralaba on the Dawson River with her husband John and their 3 kids, Lilia, Xander and Cormac. Jess is one of the panellists at Grazie Her's event up early at Rockhampton's 2024 beef event. The event sold out incredibly quickly, so we thought we'd give our Grazie Her audience a sneak peek of the panellists and their incredible stories. I've also written an article about Jess and her journey as a producer in the current issue of Grazie Her magazine, available at all good newsagents and online. Talking to Jess now, you get a sense that she is totally on purpose. The Bidgoods background and trade up to 1,500 head of cattle across their 3 properties with a big focus on regenerative practices and time-controlled grazing. She has so much knowledge to share in this episode, which I think is truly invaluable. Yet the transition to life on the land wasn't always a smooth one for Jess. I think there are plenty of us who can relate to being in the trenches with a young family whilst balancing work and farm life. For Jess, things really came to a head in 2016, when they'd be back on John's family block for about 5 years, and something really had to give.
It was a combination of things. I lived 1,200 k's from my family, so we'd already had 2 children within 2 years of each other, and buying your first property and trying to build your land base essentially and build your business at the same time as raising small children. Without my family support, John's family is around, but when you're a long way being a mum from your family, that can be hard. I'd also had some health issues after both of my first 2 children, which I was lucky enough not to have after my third, some pretty significant thyroid problems, which threw my health into turmoil both times 12 months after both the first 2. So I think when I was pregnant with my third and I was late in pregnancy and it all was becoming a little bit too much, I was really starting to think, if my health goes down again for 12 months and we're trying to build this business and we're both working off farm, this isn't sustainable. So it's sort of that combination, and also saying that if we have these assets, they have to be profitable. If we're putting this much effort in, it's got to be worth it. It can't be just a lifestyle. It's got to be a business. So that was sort of the combination. And I think my husband he wasn't enjoying what he was doing as a fitter in the mine either. His passion and what he wants to do is on the land. So it was sort of, we both knew where we wanted to be, but it was making it work. So that's where we ended up at 2016. And I think because we both hit that point together, then the conversation became real. It wasn't the other one going, no, we can keep going. It was both of us saying, no, this has to change, or it's not, when we mightn't be here in 5 and 10, 15 years like we want to be.
Because at that stage you had been on the land for about 5 years. You were both working off farm. Things were a bit of a financial pressure cooker, weren't they?
Yeah, we brought into Tingle Hill in 2011. So that was when we first got back into the land in our own way. And it was that, as we know, farm assets are expensive. So for us to get in and build up our livestock numbers, we needed that off-farm income initially to start that. So we knew we had that target of being in there for a period of time to get to a certain point. We just had to be really clear on when to get out and really make that ag business work. And it was sort of that combination of all everything that was happening in life that pushed us a little bit faster to get out of the off-farm.
What did the setup look like when you first bought into Tingle Hill, which was part of John's family's business?
Yeah, it was initially John's grandfather's block. So it's lovely, like our kids are the fourth generation here. And then it was left to the 3 sons. So initially we brought one of John's uncles out, and then we leased the other 2/3, and then were gifted very generously by John's parents a 1/3 of Tingle Hill. So we've now purchased the other 1/3. And then later on, through succession, purchased Mount Cooper, which was the property just 30 k's away where John grew up, which is lovely. And then we still lease one of John's parents' other properties at the moment, which is very funnily named Around the Bend, which people always have a bit of a giggle about.
And the properties are only within kind of 30 k's of each other, but they're very different. Can you describe how big each block is and kind of what the country looks like?
Yeah, sure. So Tingle Hill is around 630 hectares. It's on the Dawson River. So it's pretty much, it's pretty flat country, like river flats, goes from sandy loam, but predominantly different types of grey alluvial soils down into those cracking clays, flat clay soil. It's a different block to run and to manage because that heavy clay, when it's wet, can be really wet, and it doesn't have a mixture of soil types really. So it can be quite a juggle. Round the Bend is only the other side of the river. So literally where one ends, the other one starts, but you have to drive around to get there. So we have to go through Barullabar and out the western side to get to Round the Bend. But it is on the river, but it runs the other way. So it runs up into some really sandy loam country away from the river. And then Mount Cooper is a mountain because essentially, so it's got really two distinct land types. It's got the mountain, which is a combination of rosewood country and other timbers, and then it goes down into some beautiful red clay country. So it's quite different, the three properties, but I think that's what makes it interesting, and no two seasons are alike. So I like that part of it.
Circling back to before you purchased Tingle Hill, were you from the land yourself growing up?
No, I grew up in Molong, like central west New South Wales, so down in some coal country, went to school in Orange. And my parents owned businesses, so they owned a supermarket. So still self-employed, that business perspective, and owned other businesses along the way. A lot of my friends were off mixed farming places down there, so a lot of weekends I'd be on farms doing whatever kids did, got up to a lot of mischief when I think back at it. I can't believe some of the things we got away with, and always had that keen interest in land and ecology from a pretty young age, and that love of animals. So I think always had that interest but didn't grow up on it myself.
And you were drawn down that path actually from a tertiary perspective when you went to university, but you were kind of put off. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting because I remember even earlier than that, I think it was grade 11, as we'd all, I think most people back, especially in our schooling, like I know I'm only 40, but I think back, you know, you went and saw your careers advisor, they looked at your grades. I did study ag in 11 and 12, and it was my favourite subject. And I remember going to my careers advisor and saying, I think I want to do ag science. And they went, oh, no, you don't want to do that. And so then I applied for environmental science and got in. And then I remember within the first 6 months of being at Wollongong Uni, we had, and now looking back on it, it's your maturity level too and believing what people say to you. But we pretty much got told that we're going to all work in the mines. That's where the jobs were, you know, somewhere in the mining oil sector. And I went, what am I doing? Like, that's not why I'm here. Like, that's not what I want to be doing. And I ended up going and studying human movement and a Bachelor of Secondary Ed. So still like holistic and science-based, but in a totally different field.
And then after travelling and deciding to come back to Tingle Hill, what was it like then learning to all the basics of farming, the practicalities and the hands-on nature whilst you had two little kids?
Interesting. Luckily, John's patient, and he actually, when I think about it in reflection, he allows me to make mistakes. He doesn't always tell me how to do something. He allows me to figure it out a little bit for myself, which is sometimes good and sometimes frustrating when you're early on, when you're trying to learn a lot. And I think initially, because I still worked off farm, it was little bits, like I wasn't doing a lot initially. You know, it might have been helping with the cattle in the yards, shifting cattle and doing that sort of things, and more the economics, business and planning side from a strategic point of view. And then as it progressed, then the physicality of getting more hands-on and more involved, because I love being outside and I love being involved. And that real passion for grazing management and animal management came out. So then it was like us always reshuffling and navigating roles and responsibilities, like who's doing what, who's responsible for what. So that's been, it's not been something we've jumped, like it's evolved over time while we've been building a business together.
Do you have any memories that really stick out from that time when you were learning the ropes and parenting and, as you said, a long way from your own family?
Yeah, I can definitely remember getting to troughs, and I just thank God the smartphones had just come into play that we could take photos and send. Because if John was working as a fitter and I could take a photo and send to him and he could talk me through or send, like message back and forth, that sort of thing about how to fix things instead of, I don't know how I would have. I suppose you'd figure it out. You do. It's that sink or swim sort of environment. So that for that, but also I think like we've had amazing people around us in this area. We've got a lot of people that I would call mentors and really close friends that have always been there to help, like with that learning part of the journey and the ability to ask questions. And I'm probably really curious, so I'm prepared to ask questions, and I don't care if people think I look stupid. I'm okay with saying I don't know a lot, but I want to learn a lot. So I think we've been really blessed in that way as well.
Yeah, that's a skill in itself and probably undervalued. It's really important to be able to put yourself out there and not fear that you're going to look stupid if you want to develop professionally and personally. So when John was working, tell me about the shifts, and you guys were really shifts in the night a lot of the time, weren't you?
Yeah, whiteboards came into play a bit. like lists under people's names and things like that. It was definitely tag teaming. John would get off night shift, and a lot of the times I'd hand him one or then two children, and I'd go to work. And then we only had 2 days a fortnight together for a lot of those years that one of us wasn't working. And so that's the days that if cattle had to come into the yards or things like that required more than one of us, that they were the days that that happened. Lucky we love doing that stuff. It is a juggle with kids. I'm sure people can relate to that when you've got small children in cattle yards and things like that, like the safety and making sure everyone's okay. Yeah, so that was always a bit of a juggle. I look back at it now, and we were only talking about the other day after I was talking to you last time and saying, I don't know how we did that. You know what I mean? Like I think about it now and I'm like, I don't know if I could do that again, but it got us to where we are.
And it also helped you develop the grit.
It made us realize we wanted it, and it got us on the same page for what we were trying to build and the why we were trying to build it. I think that's really important. And we really do have very aligning visions with what we want to have and what we want to be and what we want to create on our place. So yeah, from that perspective, I think once we realized that we needed that, we're like, yes, this is hard, but we know where we're going and we know why we're doing it. So we're prepared to put in that initial hard yards to get there.
We did put in the hard yards. And then again, 2016, heavily pregnant, you had this chat together saying, what are we doing this for and how can we make this viable? So, what were the next steps that you both took in order to take that shift to start to dial back from working off farm?
Yeah, John dialed back pretty much immediately. So it was like cold turkey for him. I can't speak on behalf of him, but I don't think he's ever looked back in that regard. So he literally resigned, and he was going to do a little bit of casual. And it was probably a really good alignment of things just happening in the world that that mine that's local went into redundancy and closed. So there was no, so then there wasn't that option, which was great, because then we were like, righto, this has really got to work. And we didn't want him to travel. We wanted him to be home for children and business in raising the kids to be present. So then I was still working off farm. I probably took on more leadership roles at school to bridge that gap, because we still needed that off farm income at that stage. And then after that, I started looking outwardly out of education, and that's when I started working for Myer Grazing. And now I'm fortunate. I choose when and how I work off farm, and it's more that that's part of what I really want to do and what really lights me up than needing to do it from a financial perspective. It's still lovely to have it from a financial perspective. I don't mean that. We've still got a lot of debt and those sort of things, but yeah, it's more of a choice in how much we do off farm now.
It's a good place to be. So you both enrolled in Resource Consulting Services Australia's course, Grazing for Profit. How did that help you both with the direction you wanted to go? You talk a lot about aligning values, and you and John both share those. So how did that course in particular help to funnel you towards where you are now?
That 7-day course, it's rather intense. Like people refer to it as like a uni degree in a week, and it is. It's big days, but I think because it looks at land, business, people, production, all in 1 week, it is sitting down and saying, well, why are we doing this? So getting really clear on that. Do we even want to drive this business? What is it that we're trying to create? And also then giving you the base economic skills for how to drive a profitable business and understand when you are economically profitable and the difference between cash and economics, I think, is really important in agriculture to understand the difference.
What
Both are
is the
important.
difference?
Well, cash is your cash flow. So, how much cash movements are moving in and out. But we can be up in cash flow, but actually economically at a loss because our inventory value is down. So, it's knowing both are really important. We need cash to run a business. So, we need cash moving through a business, but we need to know the economics. So, the non-cash items, what are their values and how are they shifting throughout a financial year if we're looking at opening and closing. So, I think from that perspective, especially when you're in the building phase of a business, you can actually be cash can actually be quite tight because you're trying to, you know, if you're in a cropping system, you're trying to buy machinery or a lot of labor costs. In our regards, in a cattle business, we're trying to build numbers. So, you know, the turnover mightn't be there, but our inventory value is actually increasing substantially. So economically, we are becoming more profitable. However, the cash might be tight and understanding what stage of the business you're at and where you're at. So from that, I just think from that financial understanding of where you are and then where your targets should be and if you're hitting them and why you, if you are great, if you're not, why not? And what's the parts of business. So that was really important for us. And I really like diving in and analyzing that side of our business. The people side's really important to get us aligned. We were fortunate as a husband and wife team that that was already aligned, but once we got there and put it on paper, we realized how aligned we were with what we're trying to create, which is a really nice way because you come out enthused and sort of get driven into a way that you want to operate your business. And we became really clear then from the production and the land side, really what we were trying to do to the ecology and the landscape and how we're going to achieve that while being profitable. So I think it was a real kick up the ass, if I can say that, because I think before that, we were sort of because we were so distracted off farm, we hadn't put the time and energy into it. And it requires time, energy, and discipline to run a successful business. So, you know, once we made that shift, then we could put that energy and that focus into it.
It also takes a lot of courage, I think, and that probably is skipped over a bit, taking that leap of faith to say, right, this is it, we're really going to make this work. Were there sleepless nights? Were you concerned about it?
I don't normally. I've lost very little sleep. If I've done a budget and I know where we are, and John and I are probably he's a bigger risk taker than me. I think knowing where you sit on that is really good, especially for partners in business, like who is the biggest risk taker and why, and where you sit. But we're both probably prepared to take a risk and back ourselves. So with that, I think we give each other confidence. And at the end of the day, if we lose everything, we've still got each other. So we're prepared to go out and back ourselves and take that. And take that risk and back ourselves into it.
It's a bloody strong partnership that you guys have. Was it always that way, or did you have to do some things to shift it and to really focus on that?
Yeah, I think we're always working on it. We're definitely, I don't want to paint the picture, we're not a perfect couple. I don't think anything exists like that. I think we really have to focus on actually spending more time on our relationship rather than on the business. We both will put in long hours into business, but we actually need to refocus on spending more time as a husband and wife and actually coming back to the things we enjoy doing and why we started dating in the first place, like why we like hanging out. And I think that's the part we need to work on, coming back into that, because you can get a little bit, you know, kids take up a lot of energy, rightfully so, and so does business. So I think now we're at that point where we actually need to carve out more time for actually being a husband and wife first and business partner second.
And how do you think you'll do that practically? What does that look like for you guys?
I think it's just that discipline and that revisiting, isn't it? Like, you know, weekly, monthly. I had a chat with someone that I regard as a mentor, Jill Rigney, yesterday, and she reminded me of a few things and she asked some tough questions and they hit home. And I think it's about really asking yourself, where's your best energy going, you know, weekly, monthly? And if none of that is going towards your husband or your kids, well, then those relationships aren't going to flourish. And it was just that, it was what I needed just to remind me that, you know, they should be the priority. And then the other stuff will flow from that.
Well, you do have a mission statement which you do read aloud quarterly at your producer group. Can you tell me what your mission statement is?
Oh, I can't remember it all off by heart, but it's essentially the part about us is that we put our family, and each other and our health and well-being first. And the reason we have that in there is so we don't forget it, because I think we can, that can slip off the side. And we want that to be a focus. I remember that we generally do our business and personal goals off farm, just we find that it helps the stimulation to be Not at our workplace, because even though we live here and we love it, sometimes the distraction and can get in the way. So we and last time we did them, we were just, it wasn't fancy. It was just going out for coffee in Rocky in the morning and having breakfast and a conversation together to write them down. And we looked around and there was all these couples out for breakfast this morning, and they were all on their phone. They were all distracted. No one was engaging with each other. And John and I sort of were there with a pencil and paper and having this big chat about, 5 years, 10 years, where we want to be. And when we were talking like 15, 20 years down the track, we just wrote, we want to be able to go out and have a coffee together and have a conversation and still enjoy spending time together. Because it was that stark reminder that, like if we don't put effort there, that mightn't be there. So don't take it for granted.
Yeah, what you water grows. So you tell me a little bit also about the importance of this quarterly group with four other local producers. What does that look like? How did that come about, and how does it benefit you guys in a business sense?
Yeah, so the four producers were all within, I want to say, I'll probably get this a little bit wrong, but I reckon we're all within 100, 120 Ks of each other. Three of us are actually quite geographically close. All of us have been clients of RCS. Three of us have been through the executive link process where you learn how to facilitate your own meetings. And essentially, we all said we just want that peer support, but also drive in our business and those our eyes, someone else's eyes and perspective. And accountability. So we meet four times a year each meeting, and just for a day each. It's lovely, like everyone contributes to the cooking, and there's shared food, and I think that part of it's nice too. We all are very aware of what's going on in each other's lives, with some of them having grandchildren and weddings. Everyone's at a different, stage sort of thing. That's sort of nice, that sharing of life. But also we come together and each quarter has a different focus, whether it's the budget or whether it's a financial review, or and then if there's things going on with production. So it's very production and economic focused. However, there is that aligning with values, and sometimes there's things that are put on our plate, and it's just a really nice place to be able to go and have those conversations. And it is a vault, there is a code of conduct. Nothing that we say in there is spoken outside of that. So it's that freedom to speak and really share ideas and get different perspectives back, and then sort of set the next quarter and then come back and rinse and repeat, really. But it's sort of that check-in, and you've got that support network around you and just really positive, like-minded people, that I think it's one of the things that I think producers need, because it can be isolating on farm. And I think that part of pulling yourself out of it and actually looking at where you've been, where you're going, and how you're tracking in those areas is really important.
It does sound like mentoring and that professional peer support is a huge facet of you and your business. How important is it, and how much do you recommend other producers get out there and do some professional development and seek that further education?
I think it's really important. I think it's also, though, being really targeted on what, like being thoughtful about it. Like, what do you need now? What does your business need? What do you personally need? And being targeted, because I think at the moment there's so much on offer. So we can go do and be involved in days and training and whatnot. But if we're not actually targeting why we're going to something, what we want to get out of it, and then actually applying it when we get home. So that transfer of knowledge into skills is one thing I'm really interested in at the moment, because I think there's never been a time that we can absorb so much information. But I think it's that information and the transfer into skills on ground, and making a difference in our lives, that we actually need to do before we go and get the next bit, and putting it into our context. So for us, it's that we are really targeted in what we do, in terms of training or professional development or personal development. So we're not trying to do everything. We're really thinking about what do we need now? What's the next piece of the puzzle for us? And then that peer support group really keeps us motivated. And it's also a good way, because sometimes you think, oh, I haven't done much, and every quarter we reflect on what we've done. And it's sometimes that nice thing to think, oh God, like, we have done a lot. And we include personal stuff in there, because that's important as well, that we're making sure we carve out time for that as well. It's not all business. It's got to be how we're balancing that with what we want to do outside of that.
Yeah, I love that. So, are there some questions? Like, I know you just said some, but for our Grazie Her community listening, are there some questions that you recommend they turn around and ask themselves of for their business and how they move forward?
I think it can be really simple. The why question is important. So the big why, you know, why are you doing this? What do you want to create? But why are you doing it? And who's the person that you want to be? Why are you doing it? I think of Jewel Ringley in the Right Mind and people like Ben Crowe talking about this person that you want to be. I think that's where the shift needs to happen, because we can accumulate and have growth for growth's sake. But unless we're thinking about the other, you know, we're not going to be fulfilled. At the end of the day, it's going to be a bit empty. But I think also just keeping it really simple, and what does a really good day look like for you? You know, and if you're creating a business that you don't get to do those things that you love, then it's probably not going to be that enjoyable. I think about that. I talk to some people with work and they employ staff, and the staff are doing the bits of the business that they love.
So true. It happens so often.
And I think that's, you know, you've got to be really aware of the things you do love and why you're doing it, so that you can make sure that they're still becoming a big part of it. Or I think you can get lost, not lost, but distracted.
Definitely. And it's really interesting that you had such a passion and interest from a scientific ecological perspective as a young person. And it's been this full circle moment, hasn't it, to come back to?
Yeah, it has. And I like saying that I'm that nerdy science person that likes finding out the why. I still love diving into soil health, and I think it's a really cool space because we're learning so much at a rapid rate, and it just keeps moving. And I think that's the part of the ag industry that excites me the most is no two seasons are the same, but we're never going to know everything. Mm-hmm. I actually love that part of it because it constantly is changing. But I think we've got to be curious. So I love the ecology side of the business we run and the grazing management and how that links together. So, yeah, it is full circle. My favourite thing to do is shift cattle and watch cattle eat and look at the grass species and look at what's going on with the soil. Yeah, so I make sure that I have time to do that. I as well, my daughter's just been home for holidays from boarding school, and she generally on the home block will do all the cattle shifts while she's home, which is amazing because she loves it. However, I really miss it. I went out and did the first one the other day in 2 weeks because she's just gone back. And I'm like, oh, like, so lovely. So we've got to find that balance when she's home, because when she's home for 6 weeks over Christmas, or 8 weeks, I think she's home. Yeah, she doesn't
want to steal my job.
She does, which is awesome because she loves it. But I've just got to find how I can get that while she's here.
Yeah, totally. I'd love to delve into how you did start to develop your three blocks, which you are custodians of, to farm regeneratively. So what were some of the first things that you did to really start to develop the blocks?
Yeah, well, and the initial one, Tingle Hill, because it's there is a couple of different soil types coming through here, but it's a pretty simple rectangle block. So it's quite easy to develop in terms of wire and water and get pretty consistent paddock sizes with production levels being quite similar. So it was more of a, and the water access from the river, you know, it was quite simple to get water pumped up into a circuit system and split it up. So that happened pretty quickly once we decided what we were going to do and how we were going to revive the soil and the ecology and increase desirable pastures. And once we implemented that, it was a good block because I think it's that tester for how to drive the system when you're doing time control grazing and you're mobbing animals up. That feedback system's coming back to you really quickly. However, you've got to be on your game, so you've got to be making decisions quickly, and it's that constant feedback loop about what's happening in front of you, what's happening behind you, and making adjustments. So it was a really good size block for a tester for us before we went out to Mount Cooper and developed it. It's developed slightly differently because of the two very different landscapes. So the mountain is still in quite large paddocks because it's never going to be an intense system, and the return on investment isn't there to do that there because only parts of it are accessible for grazing and different species types. Whereas down the bottom, we've actually gone more intensive than Tingle Hill, but we'll probably pull up now where it's at. Thought we might develop it further than where it's at, but we don't live there. And this is the bit about it's got to fit in with your system. So the amount we're shifting cattle out there now, we don't want to increase it and make it more intense because we don't live there and we don't want to be traveling out there more than we are now. So it's got to fit within the big system of the other places we're driving and what we want to achieve. So that balance between ecology, production, but also us having a life and being able to go watch kids play sport and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so let's just take a pause and delve into what is farming regeneratively. What does that mean to you?
I think it's a really important question because I think the term regenerative is actually, for some people, it feels inclusive, and for other people, it's that, it's that's us and them. And I want to be really clear on language because I think as an industry, we need to be learning from each other and pulling everyone in. I don't think it should be exclusive. So I'm just always a bit careful with that word regenerative from that perspective, because to me it's about having a profitable business, improving landscape and increasing production. And there's a million ways to skin a cat. So it's about what system works for you and how are you going to get to those outcomes. So there's different ways to get there. And we need to come together, I think, more as an industry and think about how we're moving forward in that way to be more accountable, more transparent, and also making sure that when we're thinking about landscape, we're thinking about 100, 1,000 years out, not just for our family or what we're doing in our generation. And I think if we think about it through that lens, we can do it in a number of different ways. So for us in our business, it's really that ours is really simple. We want to leave it in a better state than we found it. And we want to be doing things that in 1,000 years' time, this is still going to be productive and profitable, and the ecology is going to be building on itself. So, and that means that we're probably going to have to watch what's happening, and sometimes we're going to have to shift track. But at the moment, we implement time control grazing. So the rest period is based on the growth rate of the plant. And essentially, we're making sure that we're matching stocking rate to carrying capacity, which means we're varying the number of cattle depending on the season, because every season is different. And even if we get the same amount of rainfall, it normally falls in different ways and different growth rates happen from it. So it's about being in tune with what's happening and making decisions early and often to ensure that we're getting the most production at the point in time we need it, but also that we're leaving in country in a condition that when it gets rain again, it's ready to go.
And so that involves for you guys subdividing the properties so that you're able to shift the cattle as one mob. So how many subdivisions does Tingle Hill and Mount Cooper have?
Yeah, so Tingle Hill is currently in 34 paddocks. The next subdivision will happen here again. It's going to go again. We'll probably take it in the next 12 to 18 months to 50 paddocks, just to get over another density threshold. And because this block is 630 hectares, we live here. It's very easy for us to go and shift stock. It's not time consuming, and it's actually something we love. So for us, that system works for us to take it up that another level of intensity that we'll be shifting more often. Mount Keeper's in just over 50 paddocks, and that'll be where it stays unless we move some fences or just add another couple in, just because we're not there. And then Round the Bend still is in time control grazing. However, because we lease that block, it's in 11 paddocks, so still one mob, the same as Tingle Hill and Mount Cooper. However, it's still done on time controlled. However, the graze period, the time they're spending in the paddocks, is longer, and we're still getting amazing results from that. We're just choosing not to go as intensive on that property.
And what are some of the results and the impacts that you have really noticed from your time-controlled grazing?
Yield is definitely, on both blocks that we've increased that intensity. It's doubled. So, the grass yield that we're able to take out of those paddocks, the ground cover has increased significantly. We always measure ground cover at the end of the non-growing season for us, because in the growing season it can mask a few things that have happened. So we always check in at the end of the non-growing. And I mean, we've got access to so much information with satellites and data that we get freely, especially in Queensland through the long paddock. So we can really track where that's going. So we do that at the end of the non-growing season. So our ground cover has increased significantly on all the properties that we're managing since we've taken over and introduced these systems. And then it's really the species composition. So that biodiversity, so the seed is there. It's about changing the seed bed and allowing to grow, and also allowing trees to come back. We've significantly allowed a lot of natural recruitment to happen, which has actually seen an increase in our productivity, and we track that through time to see how it's impacting. And it's had a positive trend so far, but that'll be something we track as the canopy cover increases. Where's the tipping point, if there is one, or will it come into a bit of a settlement in its own state coming back? So yeah, we're definitely letting natural recruitment come back, as well as planting some improved pastures in there as well.
And other factors include like you don't have any ticks, even though you're in tick country. So the impacts, the metrics are really there, aren't they?
Yeah, that's just a it's because we break the life cycle, because the only thing in Central Queensland we've got to be a bit wary of, we've had a tick outbreak once, and it was when we were coming in on our second rotation or having a cracker season. So we started pumping the cattle really quickly, and we came under 45 days into the same paddocks twice. And we were coming in just underneath the time for that cycle to be broken, and we had a tick outbreak. So now we balance that up. We'll slow down so that we're not going to come into that tick cycle. If we do buy cattle that are heavily infested with ticks, which sometimes happens because we're in a tick infested area, we will have to treat before we put them out, because they're not healthy, and we've got to think about animal health first. Then generally when they're in our system, we're not treating for ticks.
And I
So
know that your numbers do fluctuate depending on like the season, and you're able to be flexible like that, but what carrying capacity do you generally hover around?
yeah, I find that a really hard one, because when I look back at our numbers, we take on different lease and adjustment elsewhere as well. Outside of those three blocks, we're always looking for opportunity. So, where it economically is viable. So, like we've probably, we peak out at the moment with other country as well as what we've got, around that 14, 1500, and that's got to be a cracking season. Everything has to be pumping for that. But we can get down as low as 600 or 700. In a non-growing season coming off the back of dry. And in the back of 2019, Tingle Hill was totally destocked, and Round the Bend really didn't have many cattle on it at all. So, and Mount Cooper was just starting to build numbers. So, it fluctuates. And because I would call us traders slash backgrounders, so we still put weight on, we do some quick trades. We have that flexibility, and we're constantly looking at our inventory for how it shifts throughout a season.
And how do you mitigate those dry times when you are going to have to destock? How do you approach that financially, and what does that look like?
Yeah, generally because we're destocking, we're making small decisions early. So, and in Central Queensland, we have a little bit different to where you are, Em. It's in 12 months, we definitely have a wet season and a dry season, or a slow non-growing. We have those extremes. So we're coming to the end of our growing season now in April. And even if we get rain coming into May, like it's the temperature, because we have tropical grasses, we'll get quality. We don't tend to get great amount of growth because they need that soil temperature to really fire. So for us coming in now, we know how much grass we've got. It's like being in a supermarket and doing a stock take. We know how much grass we've got now. And then we work out to a green date when we've got 70% chance of getting our next start of a season. So 7 out of 10 years it'll be started by then. And so then we grass budget out to that point. So we're using data, and I think that's where we've got to be looking at relevant rainfall data, because our rainfall patterns are changing. So we've got to look at, data that's relevant to now for when our seasons are starting, because the patterns are shifting, and we can't just set dates and think that's going to be in place for the next 20 years. It's just got something we've got to keep checking in on. So from that perspective, we know how much grass we've grown, we know how many cattle we can carry through. And then we make those just small decisions early. So 18, then backed up by 19, two sort of missed seasons. The writing was on the wall really early for us. So we just started cutting into our inventory quite early, knew what was sellable, and sort of picked the market and then when to sell into that, and then held cash essentially and made sure we were smart with that, and then chose when to purchase back in, and when that opportunity arose. We also used adjustment coming back in out of 19, because we came in and we had amazing growth, and we couldn't buy the numbers. So we just had adjustment land for a very short contract while we were able to purchase around it, and just got large numbers on through adjustment to get that cash flow coming in for us to be able to have the time to buy the right article to start moving into it again.
Really, it's about retaining that ability to be nimble and to work with the conditions that are around you. It's been an enormous 12 years, obviously, and a huge period and journey of growth. What does the next 12 years look like, and what are you really focusing on now?
Yeah, well, I think having our eldest daughter go away to boarding school last year, and our son, we've got two boys after that, is our next one. Xander is going away next year, and I think it's really all been a bit of a hit home that we really want to carve out time. We've got a whiteboard written down of all the places we want to go on holidays with them over the next, however many years that they still want to hang out with us until they're too cool for us. In saying that, we really consolidation at the moment is a big thing, but there's been some opportunities arise lately that we're gonna take on as well within that, and constantly revisiting that balance for me with off-farm work, with on-farm, and how we balance that, just being really aware of where my energy is going. We have big goals of having another property acquisition later on, and that will depend a little bit on the next generation and if what we want to build with them, or if they want to build it with us. And that'll be totally up to them. But if they do, we want them to have a bit of a say in how the business evolves and grows, and what happens from there. So yeah, it'll be a work in progress that we'll keep revisiting, I'm sure.
It must make your heart sing, though, that the kids want to be with you in the yards. And like you say, your daughter loves to move cattle. What does that look like for you for the next generation? And how do you feel about that, bringing them back and ensuring that the passion is there, even if they choose not to do that professionally down the line?
Yeah, I think the passion for the next generation, isn't it? So even if they don't come back to it, they've got that respect for the landscape and the animals and the way the system operates. I think that can help them in any area they go into. I think it's going to serve them well. Yeah, if they choose to come back, I can just think, well, my son that is in grade six, he got the day off school yesterday, which we don't do frequently. So no one from Ed Queensland ring me up that. You know, he got to go out and concrete because they're building a set of yards with his dad. And then he went over and helped a neighbor. And then before school, he was up with our neighbor drafting cattle. And when I had to pick him up for school, he's like, he just wanted to keep working in the yards all day. And, you know, and also that he's up helping other people, like another generation that's a bit older than us, you know, that to me is building life skills that are really important. Yeah. So I think it's for us, it's that, I think it is that balancing line and exposing them enough for the bits they want to be involved in and giving them the freedom. And if they want to come back, how do we create that space for them? However, not having the expectation that they have to. And that's the bit that I always want to set up, that we just want them to follow what they choose, the people they choose to be. And that's totally fine with us. But if they do, how do we have the flexibility within our system to allow that to happen too?
We were just chatting before I hit record about your trail running. So obviously that's your moving meditation, and you said that's where your best thoughts happen. How do you carve out that time for yourself, and what does it mean for you to get out and lace up your running shoes?
I'm realizing in my middle age that I'm very habitual. Once I've like got a habit in, so I do exercise every morning, pretty much, probably by one. I allow myself a sleep in, which I savor once a week. But yeah, generally I get up and I move my body in some way. So if it's, you know, a HIIT session or a weight session, running is my moving meditation. I really going for long runs and being out in nature. My mind slows down, which is something I really enjoy. So I do set myself, like, you know, I'll sign up for a trail, like an ultra trail, just to give myself that kick out of bed on a Sunday morning, to go for the longer run, which gives me a bit of motivation. But I do carve out that time for myself every day. And I don't think that's selfish. I think I'm a better mum. I think I'm a better wife. I think I'm better in business because I do that. And it's just such a habit now that I probably ingrained, you know, right back when my kids were little. My kids used to come and climb out when they were toddlers and just lay beside me on the mat while I was exercising. And I've just always done it. And now I get back from a run on the weekend, and the kids cook me breakfast. So, I mean, that's pretty nice to run into. You can smell the eggs and the bacon and all of that, which is a cool, pretty cool reward. And they make me my coffee. So, and I also think it's showing them, like, that it's not about being the best, but just movement's important, and finding something that you, and I say to them, you don't have to run. It's just finding something that you love for you, where you have really good thoughts and your mind can clear, and you really enjoy, and you get into that bit of a happy space. So if I'm doing it for me, hopefully they find something for them.
Oh, you're modeling the behavior, and I'm really passionate about, you know, scrapping the word selfish, and replacing it with self-full, because now it's evidence-based that the number one indicator of if a child will thrive is if a mother is happy. And I think that we really need to keep that as our touchstone for daily decisions. And I love that you carve out that time for yourself. Jess, it's been such a joy, as always, to chat with you for the last nearly hour. So thank you so much for your generosity and your knowledge. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Em, for having me. I've really appreciated it. It's been lovely.
I had so many takeaways from this chat, and I think this would probably ring true for every listener, no matter the industry you're in. I wrote down on a notepad, actually, whilst Jess and I were talking, what does an ideal day look like for you? And I've stuck it above my computer as a reminder to check in. It's also inspired me to have a few more intentional conversations with my husband at a cafe away from home to talk about our goals and carve out a little bit of time to consciously think about the future, something that can easily be swept up in the busyness of life. I so hope you enjoyed this episode. And the number one thing you can do to tell us you did is by rating and subscribing to the podcast and leaving us a quick review. It really helps us in the podcast world to build the momentum around life on the land. And please share with your family and mates. Help spread the Grazie Her love. Until next time, keep well. My name is Em Herbert. Thanks to our producer, Jane Cudahy. And this is a Grazie Her podcast.